right. Welcome to the show, the Michael Slate Show. And I'm your host, Michael Slate. All right, settle down there. All right, everybody, take a seat. We have a large crowd in the studio today. Take a seat, and we'll get right into the show. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Reggie Gaines, poet, performer, playwright, and we're going to be talking about his new work, The Last Celebrity, so stay tuned for that. In the middle of the show, we'll be talking with David Dow, attorney and law professor in Houston, Texas, on Life Without Parole, A Different Death Penalty. This is really an important segment. And opening the show up, I'm very, very pleased to welcome to the show Peter Phillips, president of Media Freedom Foundation and former director of Project Censored, and Raymond Latta, writer for Revolution and an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. And Peter and Raymond are joining us to talk about an ad that appeared in the November 5th issue of The Nation. And the ad was a call to stand together to oppose the Obama administration's dangerous assault on fundamental rights. And it was centered up around the National Defense Authorization Act. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Raymond, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, too.
Sure.
And hi, Peter. We've never been on the radio together.
Right. Hello.
All right. Well, you guys keep it down. You know, we gotta get it. Push ahead here. Peter, let's start with you. This ad, a call to stand together to oppose the Obama administration's dangerous assault on fundamental rights. Before we get into the ad itself, let's make sure that everyone knows something about the National Defense Authorization Act, because as Project Censored has pointed out this year, this is one of the most suppressed stories, if not the most suppressed story, in the last year. Can you tell people about the NDAA?
The NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, contains provisions that give the president the authority to use military force to indefinitely detain American citizens without trial. So that's the military coming to your home and arresting you. The language of the NDAA vaguely states the power may be exercised against any person who was a part or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces engaged in hostilities with the U.S. The act can be applied to American citizens who have not been a part of any terrorist organization, who have not been accused of supporting such an organization, and that person is subject to transfer. This is a quote. Transfer to the custody and control of the person's country of origin or any foreign country or any other foreign entity. In other words, the person could be picked up here and transferred to Egypt to be tortured. So the law was incredibly, you know, violated our civil liberties. And Chris Hedges, of course, was wonderful in filing a lawsuit against it. But that the Obama administration has got that suit stayed. There's a stay against it, so the law is still intact.
Mm-hmm. So basically, I mean, this is an extremely dangerous thing going on here. And so many people, I mean, this is kind of stunning that very few people really know the full extent of this law. It's pretty incredible, actually, and pretty dangerous itself.
Well, this is a continued expansion of presidential powers that we've been seeing since 9/11. The Bush administration certainly started it. But the attack on habeas corpus, the use of military to enforce the law in the United States in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, we're seeing the emergence, we have a police state in the United States, and it's getting worse.
We have a police state in the United States. That's what you're saying, right?
It's quite clear.
Now, Raymond, what would you say to that? I mean, I've seen things in the literature around this fight, this call to resist, to stand up against this assault on fundamental rights, that's talked about, as Peter was just pointing out, that this is not just a continuation of the Bush regime's draconian measures, but it's actually a further leap in those measures. What do you have to say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is very important. Peter has hit at certain aspects, you know, crucial aspects of Section 1021, this provision that would, according to the New York Times, you know, make indefinite detention and military trials a permanent part of American law. So this does represent a leap. They've created a very vague and amorphous category of people that can be, you know, subjected to arrest, indefinite detention, as I said, without charge or trial. So this is a leap beyond what, you know, had existed in the Bush administration. A lot of people were saying, well, look, Obama is going to sort of undo some of this. He's going to call out the unconstitutional measures that were taken. But in fact, he has persevered and stepped up and escalated, you know, these repressive initiatives. You know, he's pressed forward with Bush's rendition program, you know, which relies on torture. He's extended the Patriot Act. And then he does have this quasi-official policy of kill lists in which the president, you know, Obama, reviews people that would be targeted and assassinated. And Attorney General Holder has argued that this actually meets, you know, standards of due process. And it's also, you know, very relevant that in this setting in which they've, you know, escalated, you know, their, you know, illegitimate authority to detain, arrest, and control all under the rubric of this war on terrorism, that, you know, the Obama administration announced that there'd be no charges, you know, leveled against CIA officials that participated in torture. And at the same time, there's been an unprecedented crackdown on so-called, you know, what we call whistleblowers, people that have called out from within, you know, government and, you know, agencies, called out these practices of torture. And there's been this, an unprecedented crackdown on that. So, you know, here you have the tightening, you know, clamp. And the statement, I do want to get to the statement that appeared in The Nation, that this is a very important statement. It's signed by 750 people. It includes a wide range of signers from Daniel Ellsberg and Cornell West, scholars Stephen Zunes and Donna Haraway, lawyers Michael Stephen Smith of the Center for Constitutional Rights, actors Peter Coyote and Mark Ruffalo, and they're taking a stand. All of us are taking a stand, you know, against, you know, this repressive trajectory that's underway, and in specifically focused up on this NDAA and the provision that Peter was, you know, was speaking to. And it's also taking a stand against the singling out and the targeting, the naming of the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman in a ruling by a judge at one phase of this process of challenging the law, where the party, the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian, were dragged into this case and subjected to a potentially harmful and dangerous mischaracterization. So this statement is coming at a very opportune, a very crucial time in the midst of a presidential election in which the discussion of this law and the whole repressive trajectory is a forbidden topic, along with other topics like global climate change, and in which there's a further development in the codification of this NDAA, because, as Peter pointed out, the Obama administration has moved legally to put a stay on a temporary injunction that was ordered by a federal district judge, so that this law is in full effect right now, and this very dangerous and harmful characterization of the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman, Bob Avakian, remain part of the court record.
And yet you see so little in terms of people actually standing up and doing something about this. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Phillips, president of Media Freedom Foundation and former director of Project Censored, and Raymond Latta, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. Peter, how would you explain some of that? I mean, because I think it's, you know, it's very heavy when what Raymond's saying and then what you were saying about this is a police state, this whole thing of criminalizing dissent, where people, I think, overall, they might see this, you know, one portion here, one portion there, they might stand up and do something, they'll look at the attacks on Occupy or whatever. But really, in the big picture, this law is such a huge leap in this. And when you're talking about actually codifying a police state, this is a pretty heavy thing. What have you seen as the response to this, and the question of how to break through the suppression, including with this ad?
Well, it's certainly an important story that has not been covered by corporate media in the United States. That's why it's our number one censored story for 2013, the yearbook that's just out for Project Censored. There's a long list. You can go to opposerepressionndaa.net and see the list of hundreds and hundreds of people in this country, including myself, who have signed this petition against the National Security NDAA. This is a combination package that includes everything that the Bush administration was trying back, you know, 10 years ago, and even goes back to the Clinton administration in the anti-terrorist act that they had after the Oklahoma City bombing. The National Security Agency now is building a $2 billion electronic intelligence compound in Utah, which is supposed to be completed in a year. This vast complex is going to be part of the Total Information Awareness Program, whereby everything electronically, everything we do, drone information, drones flying in the United States, it's just an eye in the sky, electronic view of all of our communications, all tied into this, so that if we in some way can be individually identified as being supportive of issues that the government doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
So it's terrifying. And then to name, I mean, Project Censored Media Freedom Foundation is the fiscal agent for this. We are not, of course, part of the Revolutionary Communist Party, but we do not like the idea that they're named as associates with this or reason for this justification. This is just completely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Raymond, you know, in relation to that, you know, there's this aspect of labeling that, you know, mislabeling the mischaracterization of the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian. And there's the aspect of this of a bigger point that you also make connected to that, very much connected to that, in terms of in the statement it's made, we will not accept the government labeling who is and who isn't a legitimate part of this movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very. This underscores the significance. I think the profound significance of the statement coming as it does, you know, at this time in the course of the case, and how this is, as I said, sort of a non-issue in the election. And the law itself, as Peter was pointing, was kind of passed in a stealth way, no public discussion or awareness. And now, in the adjudication of this law, you have, you know, this development where a genuine revolutionary organization, the Revolutionary Communist Party and its leader, Bob Avakian, have been named and singled out as something they are not. That is, you know, they are being thrown into a category that could be potentially, you know, swept up as terrorist-like organization and can be construed as outside the boundaries of what is, you know, considered protected speech and political activity. So this is very critical that the statement is taking a stand, you know, that we will not allow the government to designate who's acceptable and who's not acceptable, and we're not going to allow, you know, the powers that be to divide progressive, radical, and revolutionary organizations in ways that, you know, they determine are necessary to, you know, hold on to their, you know, to their power and to prevent any kind of, you know, opposition, dissent, and resistance. And the fact that there is a revolutionary organization, there is revolutionary leadership in the society, Bob Avakian, and they, you know, are seeking to, you know, through this ruling and the language that's been incorporated into this, you know, seeking to kind of throw the party and Avakian into this category of a terrorist-like organization. And they've consistently, the party and Avakian have consistently made clear, you know, that they are opposed, you know, to terrorist activities, opposed to that kind of approach to, you know, to political activity, and that this is something that has been clarified in a legal brief that makes very clear, you know, that the party is politically and philosophically opposed to terrorism, and that revolution is only possible when there's a revolutionary situation and a revolutionary people numbering in the millions. This statement is signed by people who have different views about the party, different understanding of it, but they are standing together and saying that we will not allow the government to designate what is and what is not, you know, politically acceptable. And this is a very powerful stand, and the statement draws parallels to 1930s Germany, you know, where, you know, the government, you know, the Nazis in power sought to peel away organization after organization. And, you know, the statement that's referenced here is the self-critical reflections of Pastor Niemöller, who said, you know, I didn't speak out when they came for the communist. I didn't speak out when they came for the socialist. I didn't speak out when they came for the trade unionist. So this statement is affirming a core principle that we must stand together in opposing this repressive onslaught, and we must stand together and not allow the government to divide forces, movements, and individuals from one another in this way.
All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Phillips, president of Media Freedom Foundation and former director of Project Censored, and Raymond Latta, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. Now, Peter, let's hear what you have to say about this Niemöller quote and the whole principle that's embodied in that, because, you know, it's interesting what you were saying about, okay, well, you know, you're not part of this party, but you absolutely refuse to allow this kind of separation, this kind of peeling off to go on. What's the significance of the Niemöller quote and that stand to you?
I think that it's what they're saying, of course, is first they came for the communists and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. And that's kind of the cutting edge. But what we're looking at here is a power elite, a 1% in the United States, in the world, that recognize there's an inevitable economic collapse, either from peak oil or environmental catastrophes or expanded wars, that's going to create probably hyperinflation, civil unrest, and they're getting ready. They've built a North American command structure. They have full information on all, and they're building an infrastructure of complete police control, backed up by the military, that can take place in any city in the United States. So inner cities may be where we first see unrest, rioting and that sort of thing. They're getting quite prepared for that, and they're putting the laws in place. Now, it's not always fair to go back and compare the U.S. to Germany. You know, I mean, we're different people. We have a different tradition. There's different understandings. However, if you go back and look at Germany, each of the repressive things that Hitler was able to do were passed and legal. They were laws that were approved. And what we're saying is we cannot allow those kinds of laws to stand on the books. We believe in habeas corpus and the right of due process. We can't allow a president to undermine that and arrest anybody and haul them off. That's just not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Raymond, anything to add to this?
Well, I do want to say that people should go to the website opposerepressionndaa.net to see the legal brief that has been filed with the court to set the record straight about what Bob Avakian and the Revolutionary Communist Party actually stand for. And as I indicated, Bob Avakian has taught consistently that the initiation or advocacy of isolated acts of violence by individuals or groups divorced from the masses of people, and to use that to attempt to substitute for revolutionary movement of millions, is wrong and harmful. So people can learn about what the actual position and orientation of the party is by looking at that brief and also another document that is posted on that site, some crucial points of revolutionary orientation. So that's something that people can learn more about. But this united stand that's being, conveyed in this statement is extremely, extremely important, especially in the face of, this stepped-up repressive onslaught that we're talking about today. And we cannot allow the government, to find ways to expand its capabilities to carry out persecution, investigation, and harassment against, the activities of the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman, or to invite, attacks, by reactionary forces. So this is a point about standing together and learning from each other, and right now issuing this wake-up call to people in society. This is what the NDA represents. This is how it's being, engineered and rammed through. This is how it's being legitimated and legalized. And this is a situation that requires that people, understand what's going on, resist it, and resist, together, to join together and to bolster our capability to unite and fight in ever more determined ways. And in this context, we can exchange views, we can, learn more about all the different, forces and movements that are involved in this. And I think it's very important for people to go to the site to see also the institutional, affiliations and organizational affiliations that are reflected, in this statement. There are lawyers, there are professors, there are artists, there are environmental activists, and we are taking this, this stand, to stand together to oppose this administration's dangerous onslaught in fundamental rights. And I think it's important to understand that whoever wins the election, that you have Obama putting these new precedents in place, these new mechanisms in place, and any future administration will take those. And those are the starting point for the way in which this whole repressive, structure of control has been, developed since and refined since 9/11.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Phillips, president of Media Freedom Foundation and former director of Project Censored, and Raymond Latta, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. All right, we have about 1 minute left, and I just want to ask a real quick question. I don't know which one of you would be better equipped to answer it, so we'll have a contest. where do things stand now with all the legal cases? Where do things stand now? I understand that the law is in effect, but what about the, what is there any further appeals? Is there anything else going on?
There's a Peter. I don't know that right now. A higher court has overturned an injunction, the temporary injunction that existed, an injunction against this provision of the act. It's going to appeals, and in December of this year, there'll be more hearings and legal legal activity around that. So in December, there's going to be apparently the beginning of another round of appeals. But right now, the law is in effect, and the fact that the Obama administration has moved so quickly and decisively to undo this temporary, and then it became a permanent injunction, which was then overturned by the Obama, lawyers and going into the courts with this, indicates that this is going to be a process in which the government is going to seek to make this permanent and to prevent any kind of serious legal opposition to it. So all of this underscores, as I said, the timeliness and the urgency, actually, of this statement and the principles it's fighting for and conveying about, how we have to stand together.
Okay, Peter, you have any closing remarks?
Just all the more reason that when 900 of us sign this, and thousands of people should be signing this and endorsing this, it'll go all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court clearly acknowledges, public concerns about laws that repress us. And so, it's going to be a long-term battle, and we're going to have to continue to stand together in a very united way to resist this.
All right, folks. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Peter Phillips, president of Media Freedom Foundation and former director of Project Censored, and Raymond Latta, writer for Revolution Newspaper and an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism. And we've been talking about the ad that appeared in the November 5th issue of The Nation magazine, a call to stand together to oppose the Obama administration's dangerous assault on fundamental rights, talking about the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and the thing that Project Censored has called the most suppressed story of the last year. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we will be joined by David Dow, attorney and law professor in Houston, Texas, to talk about life without parole, a different kind of death penalty. So stay tuned.
Well, my soul, Louisiana, but my body lies in Tennessee. I didn't kill no brakeman. I didn't kill no engineer. Well, a white man pointed his finger and they said what they always say. They didn't bother to hang me. They just shot me on the spot.
All right, my soul's in Louisiana, and that's from Otis Taylor. Just a killer cat, man, just a killer cat. Haven't found one thing of his that I don't get addicted to. All right, we're going to start our next segment in just a second because we did get a call and somebody wanted to find out what the wanted me to repeat the address, the website of the Oppose Repression, the NDAA statement, the statement against the NDAA. And that website is opposerepressionndaa.net. Okay, opposerepressionndaa.net. Well, joining us now is David Dow. And I just recently, I was paging around, looking through things, and I found an article that said, Life Without Parole, a Different Death Penalty. And it was in The Nation, and it really struck me. And I read it, and I thought, this is something I really have to talk about. And David Dow is the Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and the Rorschach Visiting Professor of History at Rice University. His most recent book is a memoir, The Autobiography of an Execution. And he's also, I think, the founder of the Texas Innocence Project or Texas Innocence Center. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. This was, and I'm sure you've gotten this. This was the title of your article, Life Without Parole, a Different Death Penalty, is something that immediately grabbed me, and I'm sure it grabbed many other people. And people, if they were like me, were saying, on the one hand, yeah, that's right. On the other hand, so what are you talking about here?
I've been a death penalty lawyer for a long time, so I've known a lot of guys facing execution. And one of the reasons that I'm a death penalty lawyer is because I think that it's a mistake to conclude that there are just lots and lots and lots of people that we should give up on just because they do something that's truly horrible. And from my point of view, throwing somebody in prison for the rest of their lives, throwing away the key, is giving up on them every bit as much as executing them is giving up on them.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with David Dow, attorney and law professor in Houston, Texas, and we're talking about his article that appeared in Nation magazine, Life Without Parole, A Different Death Penalty. And that's a very powerful argument that you make, and this is something that people, I don't think a lot of people understand this. This is actually a very big issue in California right now because of Proposition 34, the Savings, Accountability, and Full Enforcement for California Act, which actually would replace the death penalty with mandatory life without parole. And this is, I mean, you know, it's very hard, I think, for people to understand what does that actually mean physically? That this is, you know, I remember when Mumia, when the death sentence was taken away from, was taken off of Mumia, you know, there was a reason to be glad that he wouldn't be killed. But on the other hand, somebody remarked to me that, well, you know, now he's going to have a living death, which is a pretty intense thing.
Right. I think that the idea of life without parole gets a lot of traction for several different reasons. One reason is that we've really become aware as a country over the last 15, even 20 years, how often the criminal justice system makes mistakes. You know, we've had 300 people in the U.S. exonerated because of DNA. So this notion that the criminal justice system is perfect is a notion that's really just been shattered. And I think that people tend to worry more than anything else about the possibility of executing an innocent person, even though mathematically it doesn't make sense to spend so much time worrying about that. Most people who are in prison for something they didn't do, they're not on death row at all. But nevertheless, I think that one reason that life without parole has gotten some traction is because people think to themselves, well, if the guy's innocent, then at least he won't be executed and he'll have the rest of his life to prove it. So I think that's one reason. I think a second reason is that people who are against the death penalty have, in my judgment, over the last few years become single-mindedly focused on driving down the number of executions, almost no matter what the cost. And so there's been a real chasm that's opened up in the anti-death penalty community between people who have seized on life without parole as a tactic in order to get to that objective as of lowering the number of executions, and people in the anti-death penalty community like me, who think that that's really a moral surrender. I mean, if the reason you're against the death penalty is because you think not only that it's wrong to kill, but also because people are capable of redemption, even people who do something horrible can repent for it, and even people who do something horrible can be released from prison, at least many of them can, one day, without any risk to society. If you believe that, as I do, then life without parole is no different from the death penalty, because you're saying we're just going to keep these people in prison for the rest of their lives, even if what they did when they were, you know, 19 years old, and even if 40 years later, when they're not quite 60, they've become entirely different people, and they could be released and be productive members of society and pose no realistic threat to society, but we're just going to keep them in prison anyway because we've decided that reducing the number of death sentences is worth that human sacrifice. I just don't share that view. And what to me, you know, I mean, I love California, but to me what makes it all the more extraordinary is that this is being pushed so hard by anti-death penalty advocates in California where, you know, you all don't even execute anybody out there. I'm looking at my calendar. I've got three clients facing execution over the next 2 weeks, three over the next 2 weeks, you know, and y'all have executed, what, 13 people over, you know, over a 20-year period. So you're not even really getting very much in return in California when you're going to put 700 people in prison for the rest of their lives, and in, you know, return, what are you getting? You're getting less than one execution a year. So I just don't even understand the trade-off.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with David Dow, attorney and law professor in Houston, Texas, and we're talking about his article that appeared in Nation magazine, Life Without Parole, A Different Death Penalty. Well, actually, just to be clear, so we don't get a flood of outraged people calling up, you do stand against the death penalty itself.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm an anti-death.
Right, I know.
I'm a death penalty lawyer. My guys are on death row. I mean, I'm trying to save their lives. I just don't want to say that all of these people who are currently on death row, we should automatically just keep in prison for the rest of their lives and throw away the key. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I certainly don't want them to be executed. But I think that saying that we're going to keep them in prison until they die of old age is morally equivalent, or, you know, maybe it's not equivalent. Maybe that's an overstatement. It is morally not significantly different from saying that we're going to execute them.
Well, you know, I would go with the first sentence you said in terms of morally equivalent to, because here's the point, except for the fact that, you know, if you're not talking, if you take it out of the realm of morality and you just say, okay, well, this will give them, this will buy them time, and perhaps somewhere down the line, things will change where life without parole will be eradicated. But at this point, I mean, I think of the California prisoner strike last year, and it spread across other parts of the country, and the people that have been held in these SHU units for their, I mean, effectively their lives. There's been people in there for like decades and decades where they, you know, and so much so that they just lose their sanity in solitary confinement. And this is the kind of thing that actually is the acceptable, and that's why the acceptable alternative to the death penalty. I thought that point that you made about the death penalty movement, the opponents, and these abolitionists have surrendering the high moral ground. The question of rehabilitation has been erased from prisons.
Yes. Yes. I, look, I'm not going to argue against you when you say that it's morally equivalent. I mean, I'm close to believing that, so I'm not inclined to argue with you. But I completely agree with what you just said, which is that, you know, 20 years ago when I started my career as a death penalty lawyer, what death penalty lawyers talked about was the same thing that abolitionists talked about, which is, look, we ought to be rehabilitating prisoners. We ought to be thinking about how we can socialize inmates. We ought to be thinking about how we can get people educated. We ought to be thinking about job training. We ought to be thinking about reentry programs once people get out of prison. And I think that most death penalty lawyers actually still think about those things, but I think that most, or I shouldn't say most, many abolitionists are no longer thinking about that. They're just thinking in a straightforward way about driving down the number of executions, even if the price that you have to pay is life without parole. And let me just say this, Michael. I think that as a tactic, there's no question but that it works. I mean, Texas was the last death penalty state to embrace life without parole 5 years ago. And the decline in new death sentences, even here in Texas, you know, the death penalty capital of the Western world, has been steep and precipitous. And I don't think that's all a result of life without parole, but some of it is surely a result of life without parole. So if you're against the death penalty and you're looking around the universe and saying, what tactics can I embrace that will drive the number of new death sentences down, life without parole is undoubtedly one of them. I just don't happen to think that it's worth the price that you have to pay.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with David Dow, attorney and law professor in Houston, Texas, and we're talking about his article that appeared in Nation magazine, Life Without Parole, A Different Death Penalty. Now, David, one of the things that comes up in relation to what you're just talking about and in relation to this whole question of the moral high ground that's sort of being ceded, but then you know, there's another aspect here that always just really, I don't know, just digs at me. It digs at me because this whole thing of the general ethos in society and the impact, you know, it allows this kind of stuff to happen in prisons. And you've been involved you commented on the case of sentencing children to life without parole, 14-year-old kids to life without parole. And the idea, and you argued then and you argue now that the idea is that you advance, you say, look, and you mentioned this earlier, you said, the person who committed that crime, whatever it was, is not the same person that exists now. That's what people actually, you know, that's with the basis of rehabilitation and things going on and help and all this other stuff. And the prison system and an ethos in society really geared towards rehabilitation instead of this society broadly is just punishment, 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 kill, 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 whether it's children, whether it's, I mean, God, they start the pipeline to prison in schools, you know, in high schools and middle schools. Start funneling people off into prison. This is a society that is only geared towards punishment.
Yes, it's a sad thing, isn't it? I gave a TED talk. Can I plug my talk on your show?
Sure.
If you go to TED.com and Google my name, David R. Dow, then you'll see the TED talk I gave. And the reason what you just said, Mike, reminded me of it is because what I talk about in that TED talk is how, in a way, the whole death penalty system is a reflection of how our society has given up on people, and not just given up on them when they're adults, but it gives up on them when they're juveniles. It gives up on them when they're children. It gives up on them even when they're infants. And we have this opportunity in almost all death penalty cases as a society to do something before a murder ever even occurs, before it ever turns into a death penalty case. But we're not focused on that. We're not focused on how we can prevent crime. We're not focused about how we can change the culture of certain communities that tend to drift towards crime. What we're just entirely focused on is waiting until criminals develop and then catching them and then punishing them severely without thought to anything else, including prevention and rehabilitation. And it hasn't always been that way. I mean, it's not one of these things where you can say that America's always been this way, United States is always different from Europe, because the truth of the matter is that 30, 40, 50 years ago, the focus in the criminal justice system was much more oriented towards rehabilitation than it is. So really, this change that we've seen has just been a change that's occurred over the last generation.
You know, and it's interesting too, David, that you know, this thing is not just happening sort of in the abstract, because actually a lot of this is, I think, very much tied up with this whole slow genocidal thing that people have been talking about mass incarceration and what, you know, and how it's focused on Black and Latino people, especially Black people. There's been this whole new Jim Crow that's developed, and this idea that when you look at the death penalty cases, how many of them are from oppressed nationalities? How many of them actually began as kids who were getting truancy tickets in school, and then after a while, one thing leads to another, you find yourself in prison, in and out of prison, and you end up facing the death penalty or life without parole. This is this whole thing, I think it's very important in terms of the ethos of society in general, the punishment, but also the very focused aim of that.
I agree. The other thing that I would say is without diminishing at all the extent to which race plays a role in the criminal justice system, and without diminishing your point at all about how if you're going to have exposure to the criminal justice system, you would much rather be white than be a person of color, because it means you hold better cards. Without diminishing those observations at all, the other thing that I would add is that I think as important as race, and if it's not as important, it's awfully close, is socioeconomic status. So you're worse off being black than you are white if you're going to have exposure to the criminal justice system, but you're also a whole lot worse off being poor than being wealthy. You could spend the rest of your life looking for somebody rich on death row in California, for that matter, in any state.
Mm-hmm. All right, David, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, me too, man. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with David Dow, attorney and law professor in Houston, Texas, on his article, Life Without Parole, A Different Kind of Death Penalty. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Reggie Gaines, the last celebrity.
And my next guest is an example of what you get when you put a little backbeat to some original poetry. What you get is people to listen. Please welcome performing everybody from his upcoming second CD, I Just Want to Catch a Cab, spoken word artist Reggie Gaines.
And now it's Alternative Nation, it's Kennedy Tarzan. And now we're going to see another spoken word performance. He's going to say it, not read it. Here's Mercury recording artist Reggie Gaines.
Please don't take my Air Jordans, a performance by poet and filmmaker Reggie Gaines, a key figure in the resurgence of the spoken word movement. He's also the co-writer of the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical Bring In the Noise, Bring In the Funk. And he joins Allen Ginsberg as my guest here on Edge.
Here performing, Please Don't Take My Air Jordans, this is Reg E. Gaines.
My next guest is a playwright who helped bring the noise and bring the funk. And as a poet, he was one of the first to open the doors for the whole movement. This is my man, I'm glad to have him here. Please welcome a true ghetto legend, the New Eurekan soul brother, my man Reggie Gaines.
Malcolm X.
Get your hand out of my pocket!
All right, welcome back. Joining us now is the man you just heard everything you could ever hear about, poet, performer, playwright, Reggie Gaines. Reggie, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
Good. You have to excuse me for stealing that trailer from you, man.
That's crazy, right? I feel kind of silly now after listening to a segment on the death penalty and life. It seems kind of almost silly, but thanks anyway for having me on the show.
Yeah, but in another sense, it's not silly, because the questions you're talking about are actually pretty important. And let's tell people what this is. You have a new piece called The Last Celebrity. What's that about? What's about it?
Well, basically, I'm getting older, And it's time to start documenting what I've been doing, you know. And so I've been pretty low-key all my life as an artist and a performer. Most of the things that have happened to me, they've accidentally happened to me. Almost everything's been almost by accident. And I've always laid in the cut in terms of publicity and just being out there. And I recently did a poetry reading, and someone asked me, like, well, how come nobody knows who you are? And I'm like, well, because that's how I want it to be. I'm afraid of that kind, you know, craziness. So we ought to do a documentary called Who is Reggie Gaines? And that kind of sparked the whole thing. Then I started looking through the archives, and I found all this footage of, I've read poetry at Woodstock Night for Arsenio Hall, MTV Spoken Word Unplugged, the Fighting Word series, Deaf Poetry for season 4 and 5, Jon Stewart Show. And I started looking at the footage, and I was like, wow, I could have been famous. I could have actually been famous if I'd have pushed it. And so I started to write how these things accidentally happened to me. And that became cliff notes for the visual. So I have this really dope performance piece where these visuals kind of tell people, like, yo, this guy could have been this, and how come you don't know this person? In the age of all, super information highway and the social media explosion, how come no one knows who this person is unless they're in the know? Well, it's almost like preaching to the choir. So that's how it all started. But I'm really trying to document what I've done.
Mm-hmm. But now you've also talked about this as a way to celebrate Black History Month. How's that work?
Oh, yeah, well, because I am Black History. You know, that's what I started realizing. So I'm trying to use this as to show people Black history as process, not as a big celebration and event, but as process. So really, everyone who does anything, like if there's a Black person who's a paramedic or an EMT who's walking up 12 flights of stairs today in the Lower East Side to bring some food to, you know, a person who's elderly and cannot get downstairs or has no water, that's Black history in process. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that's how I view it. And so things that I've done, it is Black history. So I am Black history. And so I want to show people the process of it. All right. So that we can all start to document what we're doing all the time. All right. Now that we've got the technological advances in communication and social media explosion, documentation is so much simpler than it was 10 years ago, 20, 50, even 10 years ago. So people should be documenting what they're doing, and they are, but who's documenting things that are important? So I am Black history, but I'm trying to show Black history as process as opposed to celebration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Reggie Gaines, poet, performer, playwright, and currently documenting, well, actually currently going to be known for a little while, especially when he goes on tour with this, as The Last Celebrity. Now, Reggie, let's talk about that celebrity question, because celebrity has, and I know talking with you, we've gone over this a little, the celebrity has both this negative connotation, a negative impact, but it also has a very positive thing in terms of if you want to be able to, in this society in particular, if you want to be able to have your work really have the kind of impact that it needs to have, you have to have a certain amount of impact on the superstructure of society, which requires and generates some celebrity. So let's talk. There seems to be this sort of, and I'm going to ask you to read your, your prologue to the piece, in a few minutes. But I wanted to, there's that struggle there between being a celebrity, not being a celebrity, what it puts on you, what it takes away from you.
Well, it eats away at you, first of all, because, yeah, I guess the best way for me to explain my situation, I'm one of 10 children. All right, I'm second from the top. So the way I was raised, the way I grew up, you could not think that you were better than, I can't be better than Sherry, Sean, Siobhan, Shirley, Philip Gordon, because we were all a unit. And, you know, my mother passed when we were all very young, and so we had to be together. So I come from a background where somebody would tell me in an instant, oh, you're not all of that. What about your sister? What about your brother? What about me? So and it eats away at you when people are grabbing at you and making you think that you're better than another human being, because I think that's what celebrity is. Most people get in that machine, and you have someone whose job it is or a group of people whose job it is to make you feel as if you're better than someone else because you made made a record or you wrote a dope play, you wrote a boat, you know, a poem. Very rarely does anything blow up in this society. Well, in capitalist America anyway, hardly anything blows up by chance. It goes into that machine and it's manipulated and exploited. And, you know, every once in a while something great happens just by, it just happens to happen. But for the most part, it's exploited, it's deconstructed and put, I mean, it's part of the machine, I call it. And once you get in the machine, if you got the right people behind you, you can blow up. But how often do we see things? You were just telling me about the play that Lisa Bonet was in. I don't even remember the title. But you were almost seemingly shocked that something that wonderful was even on a stage, you know, and how difficult it is for someone else now to try to take it to a larger audience because, they, you know, they feel it's something that needs to be seen slash heard, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, I mean, you were so excited just talking about it. I was like, well, I got to see this. By word of mouth, if I get a chance to see it, like, well, Michael Slate said, I need to see this. But not only he was so excited and so energized, and like, he didn't even blink when he was talking about it. That makes me excited about wanting to see it.
I could have been a zombie too, Rich.
You could have been a zombie. For sure. But, so for me, staying out of the machine has always been crucial. You and I go way back. You know that. Trying to get away from it because it doesn't, I'm not comfortable with it. You know, it's uncomfortable. And then also here, I used to do some things when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 20, 22 years old. I don't want somebody seeing me on television tonight. And then, wait, that's the guy who sold me a bag of bad dope 27 years ago. I'm going to find him. This actually is in my mind sometimes. When all the things started happening, like, I hadn't been too far removed from that type of a life. You know, so you got to be careful. Watch your back. Who do you talk? I mean, you got to know where you're at. And all of this has got nothing to do with art, but it's got everything to do with art. You know, because that's where it comes from. It comes from your soul, who you are, how you were raised, who your parents are, what kind of food you eat, you know. So I'm trying to stay out of that cesspool.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Reggie Gaines, poet, performer, playwright. Well, you know, it's interesting, too, because you also talk about your spoken word, your poetry, your theater, and there's been a melding of the two. You actually advocate that poetry is poetry as theater. And the idea of telling stories, the idea of, particularly when you're addressing people in this one, addressing a lot of black youth, about telling their stories. And I know, you know, we played your poem, Song for Gordy, and you told me the story of how that developed. And it was really a very moving story because here are these kids that actually had that kind of sense you were saying about what celebrity could be and what it should be. And yet when you did this piece, it was very simple but very powerful, and it laid this out. And you could envision – I know when I heard the piece, you envisioned the entire assassination, the murder of Trayvon Martin. You know, and that had a major impact on people. So let's talk a little bit about this in terms of poetry is theater and documenting people's lives, documenting what happens around us as theater.
Well, first of all, poetry is so accessible to everyone, which is why it is so popular. And the main reason it's so accessible is because of the nature of, or the structure and form of it. Poetry is language which is used efficiently. And so you got all these kids nowadays who have been told they can't even speak English properly. Their phonetics are shot, they can't spell, all right? And so all of a sudden they feel so comfortable about being able to say gonna instead of going to. And so it's just so mind-boggling to them that they could write something down and then say it and people would listen to them. All right. So right away it becomes theater because of the use of language. Most of the kids who I'm around or I work with or I come in contact with, they are more locked into the musicality of the words that they use based largely due to hip-hop. Because if you take most of the popular hip-hop songs over the past 30 years, most of the kids know the phrasing or the flow of it, but they don't even know the words. They can go da 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 da. It's almost like scatting or blowing a it's almost like blowing a Wayne Shorter solo saxophone or piano. So they want you to understand what they're saying, but they're more concerned that the musicality of the poetry gets into your ears, that you start bobbing your head. And I said, that's some kind of phenomenon that, like, even when I started doing poetry, I wasn't so much into it like that. I was more concerned, okay, I want to write this word down. I want these people to understand what I'm talking about. As I got better at it, wait a minute, John Coltrane could play a solo about racism and desegregation, lynching, called Alabama, ain't a single word or lyric in it, and you listen to that, and you know more about race relations and, you know, in this country than anything anybody could ever say. So as I started to get better at it, okay, it sounds simple, the musicality of the word. And so now once you get to that point, you start to realize that it becomes theatrical, because now it's musical, your body's moving, all right? Your words and your sounds start to direct you. It tells you what to do with your hands, how to move. Should I go forward? Should I go to the left? What should I do with my face and my eyes? Because the music, and to me, music is numero uno at the top of the ladder of the arts. More things can be, more complicated emotions can be conveyed through music than any other medium. That's my opinion, all right? So if I'm connected to that, it all falls in line. That's why I love musical theater. You know, it sucks for the most part, but I still love the idea of the destruction of the formula. So and I don't think that I wouldn't be into poetry / as theater if I didn't read Malcolm X. Malcolm X is theater. And Bob Avakian is theater. They're not theatrical, but they're... You know what I mean. You hear these people speak. Langston Hughes, Jane Baldwin, Billie Holiday is theater. When she sings Strange Fruit, that's theatrical. It's theatrical. It's dramatic. So poetry's always been theater. But music, the musicality of it, all right, is so much more important than the actual words. That's why a great writer, when they get connected to the musicality of it, they start to realize how every single word counts. There's no ink fish on the page. And they start to use these words because they're valuable. They're like jewels. They're like gold. Then they start to put this one against that one. Let me play that word against that one because it sounds good. Plus, this helps to fit. This particular adverb fits in really well with this and that. As you become good at it, but it's still based around this musical aspect, you don't waste any words.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Reggie Gaines, poet, performer, playwright. All right, Reg, we got about 3.5 minutes left, and I want you to do the prologue for people to this piece,
okay,
The Last Celebrity.
Go. It's opening night of the Pulitzer Prize-winning drama, Top Dog, Underdog. Sheik and I hop out of the car. He's swarmed by photographers. I step aside, witnessing the circus, when a reporter sticks her mic in my face. I wax poetically about the lack of black folk on the Great White Way, how our stories tend to be told by people who do not look like us. She seemed genuinely interested until the word minstrel leaps from my lips. She signals the cameraman to stop rolling. I move towards Sheik, who speaks Russell Simmons. The following day, on the New York Post infamous page 6, is a photograph of Sheik and an unidentifiable figure sitting above the caption which reads, Savion Glover and The Last Celebrity attend Suzanne Laurie Park's Top Dog Underdog. I sometimes wonder if the reporter ever knew my name. When we bump the black, John Stewart appears on the 9x12 screen and introduces me, and it's on.
Mm-hmm. There you go, man. You know, one thing, as you're reading that, I was thinking about the, you know, that, and I know that the stuff that you and Savion have done together have actually, the bringing together of the words and the music, and Savion bringing together the, you know, dance, not as, you know, not that dance hasn't been connected with music, but being connected with words very much too. And the question, the fact that with his feet, with his dance, he can create the music that, you know, when you look at what you did, what you guys did with Noise Funk, that was an incredible melding of this poetry, music, form, dance, you know, all these things that came together to tell a very powerful story that had to break into the superstructure in a big way. And that was one place where celebrity was really, really important.
Well, here, I know we got a little bit of time here, and we'll go to Black History. George Wolfe, Savion Glover. All right, you get the two of these guys together, but George was the one who said, you know what, we can tell very complicated emotions through dance, through tap, as music, as storytelling. And so I was able to create poems and little monologues and lyrics to songs that were cliff notes to the dance. That's how my whole life changed. Oh, I have to be sparse and very efficient with my words because the dance, what he does with his feet, is so much more powerful. Like if I want to catch a cab and I write a poem about being black and not being able to catch a cab, that's all well and good. But if Savion could tap it out and show it that way, we got a whole different way of storytelling. So yeah. I got to thank George and Savion for where I'm at right now, even with this last celebrity thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, Reg, now you're going to be reading. First of all, tell people what the plan is overall for this during Black History Month in 2013, and then tell them where they can hear about the how they can act if they want to have it come to their city, to their school, whatever. Give them a way to do that.
They could reach out to me. Well, first of all, I got 15 gigs booked in New York and New Jersey for Black History Month 2013. I'm doing the Last Celebrities tour. All right, but it's really an amazing thing that I'm able to go back east and do all these things in these black communities, high school, North New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey. I'm going to be all over the place talking to kids about, and really this piece is about telling them how important it is to document their lives and to realize that what they're doing is or could be important. And with the technological advances in digital communication, they can document what they're doing all the time. Now, will it be important enough that 50 years later, somebody's going to like, I need to check that out?
All right, Reg, and on that note, we got to wrap it up because we're just about out of time, man. All right, take care, man. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Peace.
Okay, take care, man. We're in a quick hurry, so I'm going to just say that I want to thank my board up today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to get in touch with me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And this is Germany Before the War.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before.